listening to Good evening, America. Welcome to the program. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. And to our listeners, if you'd like to join in on the conversation, have a question or comment, we encourage your call at 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. Also, the chat room is open, so if you have any questions or comments that you'd like to type into the chat room, and we can bring those to the air as well. So, Lamont, let's do the disclaimer.
Yes, and to all our listeners, we'd like to remind you that we are not attorneys, and a Just Cause Coast to Coast does not provide legal advice, so please contact your personal legal advisor for all of your legal needs. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests do not necessarily reflect that of a Just Cause or Just Cause Coast to Coast. And as always, we want to thank you for tuning in and choosing to spend just a little time with us this evening.
Thank you very much, sir. And, you know, over the past few programs, we've been talking about the IRP 6 case and the Colorado Springs Fellowship Church where the gentleman attended and the corruption and the activities that occurred regarding the grand jury process and so forth. So we're going to continue that discussion this evening. But we're going to come at it from an angle of the deception of the grand jury and the grand jury process. So I want you to stick around and join us in, join in on that conversation. But if you'd like to prepare for it, as we always welcome you to go out to freetheirp6.org. Again, freetheirp6.org, and you will find information about IRP Solutions. The gentleman, David Banks, Dave Zappolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, Demetrius Harper, and Gary Walker. They are the IRP 6, and you will find a lot of information out there, a lot of helpful information, and we hope that as you listen this evening, you will learn a little bit about what some of your rights are when it comes to, you know, if you ever are called to even be on a grand jury, or if you're called as a witness, or if you're the target of a grand jury. We're going to provide some information on that. Also, later in the program, we're going to have Attorney Solomon Weisenberg from Washington, D.C. Mr. Weisenberg is an attorney that has a lot of extensive experience in white-collar crime and defending cases where individuals have been accused of criminal activity. And so we look forward to that as well. Also, with this evening, we're going to have a profile of the wrongfully convicted, and our profile is going to be on Anthony Lemons. Again, stick around. Our program this evening is going to be talking about the deception of the grand jury. But before we go there, let's cover a couple of things that's in the news. Cliff.
Yes, I know last week we covered the fact that President Obama had mentioned that he was going to be getting very, very aggressive on doing pardons, using his power of commutation for some of these prison sentences that have gone on far too long, you know, kind of riding on the words of, I guess, is he the former Attorney General yet, Eric Holder, or is he still?
He's still there. They are fighting Ms. Lynch, but
amazing. But in the words of Eric Holder, you know, he said there's far too many people in prison for no good law enforcement reason. So President Obama, after getting to the bottom of some of the, I guess the best word you could use is corruption in the Department of Justice, they've gotten to the bottom of why there were so few commutations that had come across President Obama's desk. So he said that he's going to be getting very aggressive with pushing some of those through, especially in some of these drug cases from the last 25 years, you know, the powder versus crack cocaine cases that came mainly through the West Coast prisons. Well, in California, over the Easter weekend, the governor pardoned 82 people for their past crimes. Now,
wow.
Granted, and I think the thing that really caught my eye about this case is that, that these people, you know, each of them have already been out of prison for 10 years. but it's the fact that the pardon still meant so much to them. And they showcased one individual who had spent like 19 years in prison. But part of the article says Governor Jerry Brown on Sunday granted pardons to 83 people. An announcement by Brown's office said that each person has been out of state prison for at least 10 years and leads a productive life with no criminal convictions. Most of them have been convicted in drug and robbery cases. And this one individual, his name is Mr. Zing, and he said he felt like he won the lottery. And he says, quote, "It doesn't change the fact that I committed my crime. It doesn't change the fact that I hurt my victims, my community, my family, and myself." But he said that the pardon validates his rehabilitation. So Zing, now married with a 17-month-old daughter, works as a project director at the Community Youth Center of San Francisco. He's led over 200 anti-violence presentations telling his story, according to the governor's office. He says, hopefully with the pardon, other people who want to change their lives will see it can happen. Through work, good things will happen. And so when you look at this, you see that even people who have committed crimes and feel like they have paid their debt to society, and indeed they have. I mean, if you spent your time in prison, you've done what the state or the nation has asked you to do to rehabilitate yourself. So many times we have seen and you know, showed on this show that there's so many times that people don't get that second chance. I mean, even exonerees, their records, the crime stays on their records for years on end. We had one where there was a lady who was exonerated for a crime, and the crime stayed on her record for like 20 years after she was exonerated. And so when you look at this, it shows that even if I committed my crime, like Mr. Zing says, he still felt like he won the lottery getting pardoned, because it showed that after I paid my debt to society, now it has been validated. And so could you imagine a person who's been exonerated that did not commit a crime, how much more it would, you know, mean to them to get that off of, you know, off of their record. And I know, Lamont, with your situation, you've been fighting some of the same type stuff. And I mean, you were wrongfully convicted, spent right. The time, got out. And how long have you been fighting to get your record clear for now?
Well, 3 years. And the explanation is that the Colorado Bureau of Investigation says they don't update their database. Now,
so what? Wait, before you go on, let me tell you, just from a technical perspective, just to give a little background on me, I have, ironically, been a database developer for about 15, almost 20 years. Now, the definition of a database is a record database management system that can have records inserted, updated,
and deleted.
Yeah. How do you say we do not update our database? Then why are you calling it a database? It should be a sheet of paper written in ink or stone,
yeah.
Rather.
I mean, you know, it's one of those things that, without question, it again goes to the culture, goes to the mindset that the and I believe with all sincerity that this is something that is intentional. This is a woman, as you just stated earlier, I believe this woman was on death row, wasn't she?
Right, she was on death row.
Was on death row, and you're telling me it took 25 years, but it takes 5 minutes, go to court, and appear on your first appearance?
Yes.
Apply for a job? They already know you've appeared, and you've been accused of a crime. But I had the opportunity to look at one of the backgrounds that was done by one of the employers. I'd initially had applied about 5 different ones, made offers and everything, and they sent me a copy of the background. And nobody, no employer could read or understand. They had in very, very, you know how you have a disclaimer that you have to really read, it's
right.
Really in small print, said time set aside. But everything in bold print, convicted, felony so-and-so, conviction, showed nothing about the case being overturned, that I was retried, that I was found not guilty. None of that is on there. Just the fact that I was convicted in 2006, and that is as recent as this year, as I have attempted to get accepted at the Florence Center,
right,
to visit the IRP6 and my brother. So, again, I believe this stuff is intentionally done.
Yeah, because it makes no sense otherwise. It's like, how do you, how, that statement, we don't update our database. That makes absolutely
and gave no explanation.
And this is not 1962 where updating your database would mean going into a warehouse that has 4 million records and you have to find a particular record to update it. You're talking about the computer age where they can go in just like they ran a background check on you and delivered it to the companies that you had applied for employment. Mm-hmm. They can go in, click on a checkbox and say, you know what, let's update this record and put on there instead of he was convicted for this, tried for that, found guilty of that, and then in small print said time set aside, which means absolutely.
Well, nobody has any idea that they have no idea what that means.
Time set aside.
You know, and I'm
how about putting bold letters across the top? Exonerated
found
as
not
a crime,
guilty.
Never
absolutely.
Committed.
Well, check this out, Cliff. I'm looking at the Colorado Bureau of Investigation's website right now. And under the category of disposition, update, and sealing of an arrest record, it says that, and it gives a definition of what the disposition of a charge means and the conclusion of a criminal proceedings, what it includes. And so it says conviction, acquittal by reason of insanity, dismissal, abandonment, or indefinite postponement of criminal proceedings. Now, check this out. A decision not to file criminal charges after arrest. And then it goes on to cover up a few other things. But then it says that the disposition is not included in the criminal history record information. And it says that you can send a letter to the CBI identification unit, but it's basically saying that all these different things, it's saying that if that information is not included in your criminal history record, or if the report shows disposition unknown, then you have an obligation to contact the appropriate court to obtain the copy of the disposition, and then you go through this whole process. And like you say, this is what century are we in?
I'm telling you, this is 2015. How do you should be able to make a request. All they have to do is check that record. I mean, you don't even need human intervention.
Right.
You can put the systems online. The system can query itself and say if it found that it was overturned, that it could basically expunge your record, just erase it, and like it never existed. Erase that count off.
Wow.
Well, they'll make the statement that you have to actually petition the court to have the record removed of any kind. The court has to be petitioned. There has to be a hearing and an order issued by the judge saying, remove this off his record.
And then that has to be forwarded to the CBI.
And then there's no telling how long that sits in the stack.
After it gets lost.
Absolutely.
I mean, we've been dealing with this kind of stuff long enough to, like, you know, before the program, we were talking about that a case and saying, you know, that if DNA evidence exists, be sure to tell them to check the top shelf in the back room in the evidence room because it seems like, you know, some agencies are notorious for that type of thing. All right, so ready to move on to the next one?
Oh yeah.
All right, so this next one, we want to talk about this because, you know, when you read it, it kind of reminds you of it doesn't kind of remind you. It is such a parallel to the IRP 6 case. And, you know, a few programs back, we talked about disparity in sentencing, disparity just across the board. And if this is not a classic example of that, I don't know what is. We'll talk about the article first, and then we'll talk about the IRP 6 and how the IRP 6 case, any way you slice it, is an injustice. But this story comes from Wilcox Range News, and it's talking about, it came out about a week ago, and it's talking about former U.S. Representative Renzi reports to prison. So former U.S. Representative Rick Renzi, and he was a representative from Arizona, he was convicted of 17 counts out of 32 counts, which included corruption, money laundering, wire fraud, extortion, racketeering. It says that he also looted money from an insurance company that he established and used the money to finance his political campaign. Anybody want to kind of take a guess at if you haven't seen it already, what kind of sentence he got?
I mean, this is
3 years.
Wow. 3 years, and I mean, when you look at the list of the crimes that he got convicted of, I mean, 17 counts: corruption, money laundering, wire fraud, extortion, racketeering, and looting money from an insurance company that he established with the sole purpose to use the money to finance a political campaign.
Now, that's mob stuff.
This is all RICO Act stuff right here. And you get 3 years for it. Now, he reported, in February?
February 27th is February when, he began 27th. His, when he began his serving his sentence.
Now, how much do you want to bet that he does not spend that entire 3 years in federal prison? And how do you get 3 years? I mean, when you look at this, it says this is another anomaly about, you know, the prison system. And they say, most people say, you know, well, white collar crime, you never really get. What do you call it? You never go right away when you get convicted.
Right.
You know, you stay out on appeal, even through the sentencing, as long as the appeal is going on, you stay out of prison. Well, in his case, it says he had avoided prison through a series of appeals to federal courts filed after his conviction. When you look at the IRP 6 case, right at their conviction, they were shackled and remanded into custody by the U.S. Marshals, by Judge Christine Arguello at the hands of the U.S. Marshals.
And let's paint the picture as gross as what it is, Cliff. There were two marshals per member of the IRP 6.
Yes. Well, you're talking about...
You had 12
marshals.
Minimum 12 marshals.
Right, in the courtroom. Now, if you think about that, you think about the size of a courtroom where they're holding proceedings, and you have 12 men who are standing around the walls with shackles, not just handcuffs, shackles, waiting to take you out. Now, of course, you know, the verdict wasn't supposed to be known.
And the verdict hadn't even been announced.
And the verdict hadn't been announced, but there's 12 marshals in the room with shackles, like, well, we're here to take you away, knowing that, you know, hey, you've been found guilty,
yep,
and we're going to take you away. But you look at former Rep. Renzi. No, he stayed out on appeal. Then it says on October 9, 2013, Renzi and his attorneys appeared before a three-panel tribunal of the Ninth Circuit and argued that he was protected by a constitutional provision that gives immunity to members of Congress. Now,
what?
He's not trying to say, you know what?
He does not say, I
didn't do it. I didn't commit this crime. You know, my sentence is too steep. No, I'm protected. If I commit a crime, I am protected by a law that gives me, you know, immunity. There's that word again, immunity, because I'm a member of Congress. It said he claimed that a failed land exchange effort, which was among the main reasons for his convictions, falls under that provision. How do you say that a failed land exchange effort caused you to commit corruption, money laundering, wire fraud, extortion, and racketeering, and money looting from a insurance company? These are the type of things that when you look at this, you say, where is the fairness in the sentencing guidelines? Where is the fairness in trial? Where is the fairness with judges? Just where is the fairness in the entire justice system? But as we've heard before, you know, you buy your justice in America. It's not about the letter of the law always. It's how much can you spend for your attorney to make a deal with somebody to keep you out of prison for as long as possible, or when you do go, that you get such a great deal that, you know, like Rep. Renzi, you get 3 years for being found guilty on 17 accounts, and guaranteed he will not spend all that time.
No, he won't spend that time. And you know, it, this article even goes on to say that the irony of this is that when Renzi first made his first run for Congress back in 2002, that he accused his Democratic opponent, George Cordova, of highly questionable business practices. And they even said that Renzi ran such a tough or an abusive television campaign against Cordova that even veteran political observers said that his ads were some of the most vicious political attacks they had ever seen. And so now Renzi is having to kind of fall back on some of the same things that he was accusing other people of.
Right.
And so, and when you look at, as far as drawing a comparison to the IRP case, again, you look at 3 years. 3 years after being sentenced and found guilty on 17 counts out of 32. Now, the IRP 6, when you look at their case, everyone that has looked at it has said and confirmed that this case should have never, ever gone to trial. That's why we're going to be talking about grand jury processes here in a moment. But it should have never gone to trial, first of all.
Right.
The fact that it did go to trial, the evidence showed that the case was about debt. It was a debt collection case. This was a case in which a small business was in debt. That's all it's about. And then to get the conviction that they got and got the sentences of 7 to 11 years.
Right. And you're talking about, I mean, even with a true conviction, if there was a crime, and like you said, you know, this is a debt collection case. There was no crime. This is one corporation owing money to another. But when you see that this man got, I mean, this isn't conspiracy. This isn't fraud. You're talking about corruption, money laundering, extortion, racketeering, and looting. That is far beyond any fraud. I mean, sure, he had wire fraud thrown in there, but to get 7 years, 11 years for wire fraud and mail fraud, and to be immediately remanded into custody, not to be allowed, bond pending appeal, or any of those things, you ask yourself, where is the fairness, and is it because that Renzi was a former U.S. state representative? Is that why
congressman.
Yeah, is that why he got preferential, treatment by the courts because of who he was? It's like, so as long as you have a title, a name, some type of exposure in the public light, you can commit as many crimes as you want, and you don't get prosecuted.
And then you look at this as well, Cliff. It says that he misappropriated because he was in the insurance business as well. He misappropriated insurance premiums paid to his insurance company and used that money for political campaigns. He laundered money into his personal accounts and also into an insurance trust that he had control over. Now, you know, the other thing on this too, Cliff, is you know, when you look at people said to the IRP 6 when they got to prison, they said, did you kill somebody? Did you commit murder? I mean, you know, there's some folks in prison who kind of have it down as to what kind of sentences go with what type of convictions and so forth.
Right.
And when you look at that, it's like the vast delta there, the ocean that separates what Renzi did and what the IRP 6 were accused of doing, which we always say, and we will contend, and we continue to fight for the fact that the IRP 6 did no wrong.
That's right. And I mean, even when you look at the people that we've talked to about this case, I mean, you're talking about former prosecutors, former judges, former state attorney generals. These people have looked at the case and said, you know what, I don't see a crime. To have a former federal prosecutor say, I don't see the crime. Where is the crime? Where is the silver bullet that the government used against these six men? Where is the crime? And we, like you say, Sam, have contended there is no crime. This is a debt collection case. This is signed contracts that were not paid between two corporations. How do you call that fraud? How does that get turned into a federal crime? Because you owed one company money, and even the FBI agent who led the investigation, Agent John Smith, he testified on the stand that if IRP Solutions had paid their debt, we would not be here in court. There would be no case.
And you know, Cliff, we've heard the lie over and over and over again as well that says, well, if they had taken a plea or something along that lines, then they probably wouldn't have gotten such a long sentence, or if they had not gone pro se. Well, here's an example of U.S. Former U.S. Representative Renzi. He didn't take a plea.
Right.
He fought it all the way through the appellate process.
Several appeals.
Several appeals. And to get a three-year sentence, and like you said, he's not going to serve that 3 years. I mean, but that's the kind of thing that we need to fight for change. Because when you have that type of thing and people are subjected to this type of abuse and this type of injustice as the IRP-6 are being subjected to, it makes no sense. That's why when, you know, we hear when the truth comes on and we talk about it here, from that people always say that it's the best justice system in the world. It's not an equitable justice system. So how can it be the best when it doesn't even have a good solid standard, a good solid foundation that is built on? Everyone's just doing whatever they want to do.
Well, it goes to the consensus of unequal justice. There are two separate justice systems in this. And let's just take justice off of that. There are two different systems. Justice is left a long time ago. So you got two different judicial systems in this country. And when you have a gentleman with all of these charges, not only charges, but being convicted of, to get 3 years, and you got six IT professionals who didn't even commit a crime doing three times that amount.
Yeah.
Something's terribly wrong.
Absolutely. Let's take a quick break. This is A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. When we come back, we're going to start talking a little bit more about the IRP-6 case, as well as how the grand jury deceived people as they came, as far as witnesses are concerned, and how this whole case, the prosecutor, Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch, tried to wrap in the Colorado Springs Fellowship Church where the men attended. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this.
Each week, A Just Cause Coast to Coast shares compelling stories about judicial injustice. But AJC doesn't leave it there. AJC Radio presents top guests from across the country who are advocates, activists, attorneys, and judges who provide insight into current events and the law. Now, if you believe in what AJC is doing, we ask that you make a donation of any amount. Your kindness will be greatly appreciated. Go to www.a-justcause.com and click on the donate button. Again, www.a-justcause.com and click on the donate button.
I'm a mother.
I'm a father.
I'm a sister.
A registered nurse.
I serve my country in the United States military.
I'm your neighbor.
I sit next to you at church.
And my child was arrested,
held in custody,
questioned without my knowledge,
exposed to violence,
witnessed to rape,
placed in solitary confinement,
unable to call or see me,
shackled to a wall,
beaten,
sentenced as an adult at age 17,
sentenced as an adult at age 16,
sentenced as an adult at age 15.
We felt lost,
isolated,
ostracized,
misjudged,
terrified,
and in the absence of all hope, my child took his own life.
And then I found the Alliance for Youth Justice.
They gave me the support and resources to get through one of the most difficult times in my life.
Now I know I'm not alone.
And neither are you.
Now we have a voice.
Now we have power.
In numbers.
In numbers.
In numbers.
We can make a difference.
There are approximately 2 million children in the juvenile and criminal justice system in this country. These are the faces of those families. If you are the family member of a child who has been in the justice system, or if you are someone who supports this movement and is ready to make a difference, visit the Campaign for Youth Justice at www.campaignforyouthjustice.org.
Hey guys, I'm Jordan Sparks.
I'm Chase Crawford.
Hey, what's up? It's Usher.
Hi, I'm Rachel Bilson.
I'm Hayden Christensen.
I'm Peyton Manning.
Hey, we're Fall Out Boy.
I'm Dude Archuleta.
I'm Corbin Blue.
I'm Kristen Bell.
And we're the Jonas Brothers.
Do something good for your community.
Reuse bags and bottles and always recycle.
Help us collect 1 million pounds of food.
Helps people prepare for natural disasters.
Do something about homelessness.
Anyone could be a rock star in their community.
So then do something.
Do something.
Do something.
Do something.
Visit dosomething.org to find out how.
talk, news, politics, and inspiration.
The opinions and views expressed by guests and callers on A Just Cause Coast to Coast do not necessarily reflect those of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. Our phone number is 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. Thanks for joining us this evening. Cliff.
Yes, we are going to go to the phones before we go to this next story that has been all over the internet. I'm sure if you haven't heard about it, then you will before the night is over. But we're going to go to the phones. We have Ethel. You wanted to make a comment on the last subject we had before break?
Yes. I just wanted to say, you know, you guys were talking about the IRP 6 and when they, you know, went to court to their case and stuff. And but I wanted to say that John Walsh, who was the, you know, he's the attorney general or whatever, what is his title?
U.S. attorney.
State U.S. attorney. He was in the courtroom one of the days, you know, during the guy's case, and I was there that day. But I also remember a meeting in which the guys went to, and they met with Mr. Don Rojas. He was the director of Free Speech TV there in Denver. And when they told him that John Walsh was in the courtroom, this man and his lawyer said that was a statement, and the statement was, "I want this case. This is mine." So that's huge to me. It tells me that there was something going on there. They had already decided what they were going to do with these guys. If he came in and he never goes in and sits in a case or, in the courtroom, something was up with that from that point. That's my statement. That's all I wanted to comment on.
Okay, thank you very much for your comment. And from what we've been told, yes, that, you know, a U.S. attorney doesn't typically come in and sit down on all the cases in his district. So definitely he must have been trying to make some statement about what was going on. So,
well, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Lamont.
No. And I think, there's a lot to be discovered, not to be discovered, but there's a lot to be revealed in regards
to
the corruption of Mr. Let me take Mr. off of that. John Walsh. And his activity, and I can guarantee you, if you keep tuning into this program, we will be addressing those issues that Mr. Walsh has done several things that goes against protocol, that is violation of law, and we intend on exposing him on this program as well.
Well, and I was just going to comment, Cliff, that it's ironic that he would show up in the courtroom when he did not give the IRP6 the courtesy of a meeting to discuss the proffer that they had submitted. And, you know, when they had asked their court-appointed attorneys to accompany them to a meeting with Mr. Walsh, and they had, you know, prepared this proffer showing everything that they did, and basically outlining the fact that here's what our business was about, here's what we did, here's why we did it, and so forth and so on. And, you know, under the possibility a penalty that if anything in that proffer was considered to be a lie by the U.S. Attorney's Office, then they could, you know, pile on, you know, add on more charges. When the U.S. Attorney's Office came back and did not accuse them of lying about anything, now they came back in a letter, but as far as a face-to-face meeting, they didn't get that meeting.
I mean,
is that correct, Cliff? Do you recall if they actually had a face-to-face meeting with
They did not have a face-to-face with Walsh. A matter of fact, the response from Walsh is that he still wanted them to take a plea of conspiracy. So basically you're saying, well, we didn't find anything. Your proffer is true. All of the facts that you lay out are correct. You did, these are business dealings, everything else. But I still want you to take a conspiracy because we've spent effort. We don't want, as the U.S. Attorney's Office, to look like, we're wrong. We don't want to back down. So take a conspiracy plea.
But then he has time to show up to the trial.
Absolutely.
And he had an agenda, and that's what people need to understand. He had it. So it's as if, well, I saw your proffer, but that's irrelevant. There's an agenda of what he had in mind, and that was when you're talking about bringing in three different government agencies in a attempt to bring down the RP6 and RP Solutions, you're not hearing anything. You are blinded by hate and corruption. You're blinded. Therefore, you see nothing, hear nothing, and pay attention to nothing. And that's the bigger picture, I think, that Mr. Walsh has to deal with.
So, Cliff, I know our production team and has brought to our attention that there's a news story that's blowing up the internet right now.
Right. It's this story out of North Charleston, South Carolina. And there is an officer, Officer Michael T. Slager. He said he feared for his life because this man, who happens to be a black man, took his stun gun in a scuffle after a traffic stop on Saturday. However, there is a video that is going viral on the internet that shows Officer Slager shooting Walter Scott, who is actually fleeing from him.
He's running.
And the video, I mean, this is not like, okay, in the middle of a scuffle, the video shows the end part. This is a video that shows, that Scott is running from the officer, and he shoots him 8 times in the back. And this is not just our opinion. If you go out to CNN or New York Times or pretty much anywhere on the internet now, I mean, this thing has gone really, really viral. You'll see that the mayor has brought up murder charges against this officer, Slager, for shooting this man. I mean, when you look at this video, you say, you look at it and you say, how does someone do this? I mean, a person happened to be maybe 100 yards away behind a fence, and they got the whole thing on video. The man goes down, the officer, and I'm watching it right now. I mean, it's pretty graphic. The officer shoots the man several times in the back. He was stopped. Scott was stopped for a broken taillight.
A taillight.
And the officer later says that he feared for his life, and looking at this video, oh my God! And now he's handcuffing the man after he shot him 8 times in the back.
Okay. Let me make sure I'm clear on what you're saying here. He feared for his life with the man running away.
The man running away, and like I said, I mean, I'm watching the video right now. This is longer than the previous one I watched. After he shot him, he goes over, tells him, put your hands behind your back. I mean, the man is pretty much dead. He's laying on the ground. He's not moving. Another officer comes up. The officer Slager runs back to where his taser was lying on the ground. He's come back into the picture now. He has you see him with the taser in his hand. And obviously, they're not seeing the person who's videotaping this. But you see Officer Slager is coming over to the body. He drops the taser near Scott's body. I mean, this is after the shooting. After he shot him, he ran back like 40 yards, picked up the taser, and now is dropping it by the victim's body.
So the difference is he has no idea that he is on candid camera.
He has no idea. That's right. He has no idea that he is being videotaped. This is the person who's videotaping it is probably about 40 yards from, but you can see
him
zooming in and zooming out. So
you know what's bizarre about that, Cliff and Sam, is that how many other officers are doing things just like this that have not been recorded?
That's right.
Exactly. And I'm getting away with it. I feared for my life. That's why I fired 8 warning shots into his back.
8 warning shots.
And you know what makes this even more atrocious is that it just fuels the fire.
Absolutely.
It fuels the turmoil in this nation where white officers are killing black men. And that's one thing that we hadn't stated yet, is that this is a white officer shoots a African American man in the back while he's running away. He claims that he took his taser, yet when you look at the video,
wow,
the officer's taser is about 1 foot away from him at his feet. Now, they may have tussled over it. I don't know. But the fact is, the gentleman, Mr. Walter Scott, who was killed, he probably didn't want to get tased. So he's probably like, you know, don't hit me with that. And so,
yeah, because you get stopped for a broken taillight. You're like, why do you need to tase me for having a broken taillight?
Here's this point, Cliff, though, and Sam. The fact that there was a possible tussle doesn't stand the reason. And the reason why is the officer's actions following the shooting. If that's a legitimate thing that happened, why is the officer going back to drop the taser next to the guy's body?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That is the – and this video, I mean, this is uncut, unedited. It's about 4 minutes long. It shows all the way from, you know, Mr. Scott running, being gunned down, and, you know, handcuffed while he's dead. And Officer Slager taking the taser and putting it near his body.
Why would you put it near his body if that was a legitimate issue?
And that has to be what the mayor has seen when he watched it.
Exactly.
Video.
And you would hope that the mayor is doing what he's doing, not just because there's a video that surfaced.
Yeah, you'd hope.
But
so,
you know, this happened on Saturday, I believe.
Yes,
is that correct?
Saturday.
So it happened on Saturday. Today it's Tuesday. So there had been, to our knowledge, no action had taken place in this case until today. And today is when that video surfaced. But, you know, the Officer Slager in South Carolina has been charged with murder. And so let's see how that one plays out. All right, ready to move on to our main subject of the evening, and that's the grand jury process and how the grand jury process is very deceptive. And when you look at the IRP 6 case, it's one of those cases, again, like we said, number one, it should have never gone to trial. Number two, there were two grand juries. The first grand jury heard from several witnesses, and those witnesses explained what IRP was about. One of the IRP 6, Dave Zappolo, took in a binder to the grand jury, which outlined everything that IRP was about. He asked the grand jury, do you want to see what this is and what the company was about? The grand jury said yes. And in that situation, they came back. They did not return an indictment. A second grand jury was impaneled. And during the second grand jury, there was only one witness that was called. And that witness was Robert Moen, FBI agent. And as we already know, the indictment came down. The IRP 6 ended up going to trial in 2011. They have now been wrongfully convicted and wrongfully incarcerated for nearly 3 years. And, you know, this is just atrocious. You know, we talked about former U.S. attorney, former U.S. representative Renzi, and all the things that he was charged with, and he was found guilty of 17 charges. Out of 32, and he was only sentenced to 3 years. IRP 6, 7 to 11 years. So, you know, when you look at this kind of thing, and then folks who were called to the grand jury for the IRP 6, like Dave Zappolo, for instance, he was told emphatically that he was not under investigation. Mr. Zappolo is sitting in prison right now.
Yeah, and how do you justify that? And that is where the I guess lack of understanding by the public, by the lay citizen, that's where the lack of understanding comes in. Is that you are told one thing, something else happens, and then you don't understand how you're supposed to fight that. How it is that I came to the grand jury being told that I wasn't brought up on that I wasn't under investigation, that I wasn't the target, but yet I'm indicted, and then I'm sentenced to federal prison. And when you look at, you know, if we go back to the issue of the grand jury being impaneled a second time, and this speaks to John Walsh and his office as the U.S. attorney up there in Denver, Colorado. Article 9-11.120 of the power of a grand jury is limited by its function. It states in one of its subsection 2, that once a grand jury returns a no bill or otherwise acts on the merits and declining to return an indictment, the same matter, i.e. the same transaction or event and the same putative defendant, should not be presented to another grand jury or resubmitted to the same grand jury without first securing the approval of the responsible United States attorney. And when we look at this, the grand jury proceedings in the IRP 6 case, the first grand jury, several witnesses were called. There were several, the witnesses that they called were, as we dealt with last week, members of Colorado Springs Fellowship Church that dispelled the notion of the assistant U.S. attorney that there was something going on as far as money laundering, anything to that effect, between IRP Solutions and Colorado Springs Fellowship. And we dealt with that issue. The second grand jury that was impaneled, the prosecutor, and in this case, when I looked at that, at some of that transcript that was anonymously sent to Colorado Springs Fellowship, and reading over that, John Walsh is the one that basically was the prosecutor in that second grand jury. He only called one witness, which was an FBI agent Moen, who ironically, during when he was trying to be when the process server tried to serve him a subpoena to show or not a subpoena, a summons to show up during the IRP 6 trial, another FBI agent came and basically harassed the process server, telling him that Agent Moen would not be served. So you look at that John Walsh was the one who was in position to re-impanel a grand jury. He makes that authorization, then presides over those hearings himself, only brings in one witness who told lie after lie after lie to receive an indictment without bringing in any exculpatory evidence, which, as Sam said, was provided by Dave Zerpolo in the first grand jury. And when you look at some of the rules of the grand jury, one of the rules is that prosecutors, and I'm reading this verbatim from NOLO.com, and it's in their legal encyclopedia section, and it's talking about grand jurors, and one of the excerpts says prosecutors technically have an obligation to present exculpatory evidence that suggests that a defendant might not be guilty, though there is not much other than the prosecutor's conscience to enforce this rule. Then it goes down a little lower. It says, according to a U.S. Department of Justice study on plea bargaining, grand juries are notorious for being rubber stamps for the prosecutor for virtually all routine criminal matters. So what this is saying, that, yes, the rule, the law, the process, the procedure says that exculpatory evidence has to be presented to a grand jury when you're basically, when they are impaneled. You have the right to show that a defendant, that there's evidence that could show that a defendant is innocent. That's what exculpatory evidence is. But they're just relying on the prosecutor's conscience to enforce this rule. Why is that? Why is this rule not being held to, and why is it not being enforced? Why isn't there some third party, disinterested party that comes in after grand jury proceedings and says, let's look at what happened during the grand jury that came up with this indictment and make sure that they follow the proper process, especially the prosecutor. This is the prosecutor has his own conscience to lean on. Well, what if you get a prosecutor who has no conscience? What happens when you have a prosecutor who says, well, I don't care if the whole story is a complete lie because I have immunity because I'm in the act of doing my job?
Well, he doesn't need immunity for one reason, because there's no accountability in that room.
That's right, because there is it, and then furthermore, it's a secret process. None of it ever comes out,
exactly,
unless it happens in discovery. And in the case of the IRP 6, their pro se litigants, so they ended up with their own discovery of the grand jury process. That's how they found out these things that happened that never should have.
And it says here on some of the research that was done here as well that in a regular criminal proceedings, hearsay evidence is not usually allowed. Well, sometimes it's allowed, sometimes it's not at the discretion of the judge. This also goes to the point that it says here that hearsay evidence is information given by a person concerning what someone else said outside of the court. Frank Castell, he's an alias, notorious organized crime figure of the 1940s and 50s, argued that his conviction for federal income tax evasion should be overturned because the grand jury that indicted him heard only hearsay evidence. The Supreme Court rejected his claim and gave no credence to his argument. So again, I think we said this last week on the program that people say that the grand jury is not a trial. That's exactly what it is. If you don't allow hearsay in a criminal proceedings and it's against protocol, how can you allow that at a grand jury? So what I'm saying is these particular things that we're pointing out tonight builds a huge monster here is what happens. So once you let a little bit of the law be violated here and you do it over here and you do it over there, by the time you get done with that process, it is what it is today. It is a joke. That's all it is, because there's no justice involved with it. There's nothing involved in the grand jury where you think, well, man, the grand jury is going to hear the truth. How can you say that? When no defense, no type of other theory of the case is presented to the grand jury. There is no other theory.
Yes.
So what you plant in the minds of these people sitting on that grand jury, they hear one thing, and that's the theory of the prosecution and the theory of the U.S. attorney.
That's it, and it's a sickening process, because if you have, like I said, a crooked prosecutor and he leans on his immunity, if something ever comes out, of course he's trying to get an indictment. Why would he lean to his so-called own conscience to bring in exculpatory evidence? Then if he's doing that, why does he have the grand jury impaneled? There's no need to impanel him if I'm going to show you evidence that disputes what I'm saying.
Absolutely.
Why should he? It absolutely makes no sense, but there should be some type of oversight on the grand jury process. If, you know, better yet, it needs to be dissolved totally in the first place. The whole grand jury process is sickening. It's one-sided. How about have a hearing and say, let me present my evidence and you present your evidence, prosecutor, and we'll see if you have enough for an indictment.
Grand jury to come back.
Right. If I can fight for myself, if I can present some evidence that shows that I'm innocent, we don't need a grand jury trying to make a decision off of lies that you told and the fact that you haven't presented any evidence.
Absolutely.
The process is amazingly one-sided.
Absolutely.
Yeah, this stuff really gets to you after a while.
All right, so joining us on the line is Howell Woltz, and Howell has been a guest here on A Just Cause Coast to Coast before. And so, Howell, we appreciate you calling in. We know that this subject is near and dear to your heart, and when we saw you in the queue and you said you wanted to chime in on this conversation, how you been?
First of all, I'm so proud of you guys for what you're doing. I mean, you are doing, well, I don't want to offend anybody out there but the Lord's work, but you're doing great work. And, the IRP6 are in our prayers every day, and what those guys are enduring, I endured, as you know, but looks like my case is being overturned after 9 years of lies. But anyway, that's a different subject. But I'm so glad you're bringing this issue up, because this is the problem. Mass incarceration is the result. The problem is the secrecy, the grand jury, the ability of prosecutors to put forth false witnesses knowingly and have immunity for anything they did. And I'm just so glad you're bringing it up. But how are you guys doing?
Well, pretty well.
We're doing great. Just staying in the fight, as they say.
Well, will you tell my sweetheart Ethel hello on the air?
Yeah, we will definitely pass that on. I'm thinking I'll probably see Ethel tomorrow night, and I will definitely pass on to her that Mr. Howell Woltz says, hello, sweetheart.
on the air. Okay, I don't want to upset her husband and all her boyfriends, but you know what, John, what are you going to think about? But you know, the work you guys are doing is fantastic, and I would like to just share with you that there is a means for people to actually go after these bad actors of government who are acting under color of law and violating the law themselves. And you know, one case alone that I researched, there were 56 violations of federal law and constitutional violations of the rights of the defendant by one senior federal judge and one assistant U.S. attorney. Yet these people are above the law, by their own granting of it, in a case that goes back to 67, which has been expanded, and now they've granted themselves immunity. But if your listeners will take the time to look up 18 U.S.C., Section 3332. I'm working with a worldwide group right now. I just got back from India. I'm going to the EU here pretty soon. We're trying to build an outside coalition to pressure the United States to follow its own laws. And this statute allows for anyone to put forth a case to the U.S. Attorney's Office against these criminals in government, like the judge in the IRP 6 case, the prosecutors. And though they're granted immunity by themselves, that's a violation of the 14th Amendment. So there's a case to be fought there. Mm-hmm. File a complaint with the U.S. attorney in your district, and the law says such alleged offenses may be brought to the attention of the grand jury by the court or by any attorney appearing on the behalf of the United States for the presentation of evidence. Any such attorney receiving information concerning such an alleged offense from any other person shall, not might, if requested by such other person, inform the grand jury of such alleged offenses. So we have a means, and I've talked to a number of attorneys. None of them ever knew it. And if I hadn't been in prison for 7 years for something I didn't do, reading the law books, I never would have run across it. But I thought, these guys must have left us a way to get to the bad people that are abusing the law and the system. That's it, gentlemen. So anyway, I don't want to hold you up.
Love so talking. Howell, before you go, give us that statute again.
It is 18 U.S.C. Section 3332A, powers and duties of a grand jury, and I just read you the pertinent two paragraphs that allow any citizen of the United States who has been wronged by these animals in government who respect no law, and that you can go after them. And the U.S. attorney, though he might bend it, twist it, as you know, is the common practice in a grand jury, to his own uses, they must present your case as presented if that other person requests that to be done. So you need to do it in writing so that, you know, they can't claim they didn't get it. But that's the law, that's the statute, and there's some pretty powerful organizations getting ready to use it on the Guantanamo Bay people that have been violated for so many years. And my argument was, wait a minute, I suffered everything but waterboarding, and now my case is being overturned after 9 years. So, you know, so come on, why can't we in the U.S. use it too? So that's what we need to do. We need to hold these people's feet to the fire until they either get burned or they quit doing what they're doing.
And Mr. Welch, we thank you. This is Lamont here. Thank you for, we want to say thank you for your support for the IRP 6, for your belief in justice and what you do. Our hats off to you as well, and we appreciate your accolades that you've given us today on this program.
And how, before you go, you know.
Sam or Cliff?
That was Lamont. This is Cliff now. Lamont is, I don't think he was, he may not have been on the show when we had you on, but he is our contributing analyst. He as well spent 7 years wrongfully convicted, incarcerated, and stay in a state prison here in Colorado. And he has been released. He is still trying to get his name cleared. You know how that goes. You've been fighting that for 9 years. But if you could give us a little update on your case, how things are going with that, and also we know that you have the Ombudsman Now campaign going on. Give us a little bit of update on how those things are going.
Well, on the case, a federal judge from another state, because North Carolina is so corrupt now, they will not address, you know, any of their own wrongdoing. So a federal judge from another state filed a habeas corpus petition saying, you know, how did you hold this guy in prison for 7 years? He was never convicted in or by any court of jurisdiction. So the government was ordered to explain how they did what they did within 40 days, and they basically defaulted. So just 2 days ago, Sunday evening, we filed a petition for default judgment. So they might come out of the woodwork now, but they could not even explain how they did what they did, which almost made me madder than if they had come out and at least fought the last battle. So anyway, but I would like to, an ombudsman now, that is the answer, I think, is to have an ombudsman. So when these people break the law under color of law, we the people have someone fighting for us. And if people would go to our site, www.ombudsmannow.org, ombudsmannow.org, or justicedenied.com, then we explain how you can sign up for this petition to Congress. But we've got to change the grand jury system before anything else will change. The wrongful, horrible, horrible circumstance that happened in North Charleston today, at least, you know, they're going after the guy for a change. But what if he hadn't had that other person filming it? The IRP six guys, suppose there had been an attorney in the room at the grand jury hearing, which is not allowed. A defendant is not allowed to have an attorney. I mean, it's in secret. It used to be a public affair where both sides were issued and 16 to 23 people, you know, they said, well, wait a minute, how about you and how about you? And they ran the show. Now it's in secret, as Jeremy Benham said, you know, all manner of evil has full sway behind closed doors when government closes them. So we got to stop this. It's got to get redone and become a public affair again. But anyway, I digress. But I'm just so proud of what you guys are doing, and thank you for everything you are and your courage, which I know it takes, because I mean, I still have marshals driving down my road threatening me because I keep fighting them, and as of last Monday anyway. But you know, it's not an easy way to go, but God bless you for doing it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Al. We appreciate it. We appreciate your support, and thanks for calling in and sharing some information that we can all use. And we certainly appreciate your support of the IRP 6. Have a good evening.
Thank you, Justin. Take care.
Thank you, Al. All right, we're going to go to a quick break, and then we're going to come back and talk a little bit more about this subject of the deception of the grand jury. That was Hal Woltz, and we're going to post information about Hal and some of the initiatives that he has going there. This is A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Our phone number is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. 8976. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness
are all courtesy of the heroic men and women of the United States military.
They give so much and they ask so little.
I'm Joe Bontania.
I'm Jack Scalia.
I'm Nick Searcy.
I'm Bonnie Jill Laughlin.
I'm Scott Elrod. Please help me thank our heroes by doing something.
Donate your time, talent, or gifts
to groups and organizations devoted to our troops and their families.
Visit a veteran's hospital.
A smile, a hug,
a shoulder, a handshake,
or even an attentive ear goes a long, long way.
Quite simply, give.
They'll sincerely appreciate it.
And it just might do wonders for you, too.
Remember, freedom isn't free.
Freedom isn't free.
Freedom isn't free. Get involved.
Give back now.
God bless America.
Can you imagine spending 20 years of your life in prison for a crime you didn't commit? Neither could I until I got the opportunity to portray Betty Ann Waters in the film Conviction, telling the real story of how she freed her brother Kenny. Sadly, what happened to Kenny happens far more often than you might expect, but together we can stop it. Please join me in helping the Innocence Project fight injustice. Go to innocenceproject.org to make a donation and get involved.
Over 1 million people are sitting in the prisons of America
for nonviolent offenses. That's why I'm asking you to join the American Civil Liberties Union and help us in the fight to end mass incarceration. We spend over $80 billion a year incarcerating people. Alternatives to prison, like community service, drug treatment, and rehabilitation, costs less and can turn lives around. It's time for fair justice. It's time for smart justice. And we need your help.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. Our phone number is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. And we're talking about the deception of the grand jury this evening and how it applied to the IRP 6 case and how they tried to wrap in the Colorado Springs Fellowship Church, where the gentleman attended. And we would invite you to go out to the archives to listen to some of the other programs that we've had on this subject. You can go to ajcradio.com. Again, ajcradio.com. Cliff, you know, some of the points that Howell raised when he was talking as far as it being a secret process, the grand jury, and so forth. And, you know, we have this article that talks about why prosecutors choose grand juries instead of a preliminary hearing. And you kind of touched on it a little bit before in the previous segment as well. And, you know, and there is a, in Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, Rule 5.1, preliminary hearing, that's where someone who is accused will appear before a magistrate judge, and the magistrate will hear the evidence. In this situation, the person who is accused, the defendant, has an opportunity to cross-examine based on information and evidence that's being presented. Now, there are certain restrictions on that, but at least the person who's being accused has an opportunity to plead their case, so to speak. In the grand jury, they have no such option. And that's where the problem comes in, because as we talked about before, and as you mentioned, Cliff, the grand jury process has basically been come to known has become known as a process that is just a rubber stamp. I mean, even in this article, it says that the grand jury process is prosecutor friendly. That's because they only get to hear
exactly
what the prosecutor has to say. They don't get to hear anything as far as what the defendants have to say. Except in the case of the IRP 6, when Mr. Zappolo took evidence in there and showed him, you know, here's what this case is really about. And, you know, that's actually a good demonstration of how the system will work if it's allowed to work properly. But when you interject the corruption and the cover-up and the secrecy and all this stuff, then you get what you get.
Well, it sounds like to me, and I don't know if you folks agree, Sam or Cliff, that it's kind of given the prosecution two opportunities to actually charge someone with a crime.
Right.
Because here's the difference. If a prosecutor fails at the grand jury level, it is in his discretion, in his job description, to file charges.
Yep.
Without the indictment of a grand jury. So if that is the case, that is so far outside the realms of fairness
Right, because all they're trying to do is say, okay, well, we took the information before a grand jury, mm-hmm. and they looked at it, and they feel like there's probable cause that you're guilty to. Well, if all you do mm-hmm. is take in a lie and say, well, we believe Cliff Stewart killed this man, and the reason we believe is because he lives in the same state as this individual, and at some point in time, they drove down the same street. We have a video with Mr. Stewart's car on Saturday on I-25 northbound, and we have another video of this man southbound the next Tuesday. We're going to bring him up, and we want an indictment to say that he did it. There does not even have to be any type of collaborating evidence to say you're anywhere involved in any type of crime. Just like in the IRP 6 case, when U.S. Attorney Walsh, all he did was say, present some timesheets and say, here's some timesheets that, consultants, contractors at IRP Solutions signed while they were supposed to be working on a project. We believe these timesheets, because they were sent through the mail, because they were sent as faxes, mail fraud and wire fraud, because they haven't paid their bills. What type of information could you have taken to a grand jury to bring up any type of evidence? It's absolutely ludicrous. And then to say, well, they may have been working on a product that we don't know if it was viable or not. Well, you're a liar because it had already been proven that it was. But there does not even have to be any real evidence. Because the fact is, it is only from the prosecutor's standpoint. So if he wants to say, you committed a crime and I have evidence that says so, even if he lies, he has blanket immunity for the lies that he told in the line of his job.
Well, as we said earlier, immunity is required in a situation, or expected, if you will, in a situation where accountability is in place. Is to say that, well, the judge says this, but I have immunity. The problem here, there is no checks and balance system.
Right.
You are not answerable to anybody. There are no eyewitnesses to the conduct that you conduct yourself in the presence of a grand jury. There is no validating evidence or your supposed accusations that you have brought against anybody that indictment is going before the grand jury. So when you have that on the table, you're talking about, we said earlier about throwing it out.
Mm-hmm.
It goes against every even fake show of justice that this country shows. I mean, the perception of real justice is even not at work here, because it goes against everything. When can you go into a courtroom and you be not accountable, and nobody is there to give an account of what you do in proceedings?
And that is a sickening part of the grand jury process, because, just as in the IRP 6 case, and the reason we keep referring to that is because we're very familiar with the things that happen there in the grand jury. Most of the time, the grand jury process, and it is a secret process, and, we'll get into that, because it makes no sense that it's secret. Because if you didn't do anything crooked, why do you need to hide it? But with the witnesses that were there that we talked to last week, you realize that, okay, this is there's no other word for it except it's just a dumb process. It makes absolutely no sense.
Well, we make this point today that we're talking about the manipulation.
Right.
I have the definition of manipulation. It says to use or change information in a skillful way.
Wow.
Or for a particular purpose, to treat or operate with or as if used by means, especially in a skillful manner, to manage or utilize skillfully, to control or play upon by artful, unfair, insidious means, especially to one's own advantage.
So what you just read is that the prosecutor is the con man.
That's what he is.
I mean, he is the one who comes in. Now you take the IRP 6 case, and you take the fact that some of these members of Colorado Springs Fellowship that happen to be consultants at mm-hmm. IRP Solutions, they were called in saying, we need you to come in as a witness. We want you to testify before the grand jury about some of the going-ons of business activities at IRP Solutions, if you know any of that information. Then when they get in front of the grand jury, mm-hmm. from what we were told mm-hmm. last week, what do we have? Five people mm-hmm. on the phone that called up and says, yeah, I was a consultant at IRP Solutions.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a member of Colorado Springs Fellowship. I was called as a witness to the grand jury for a case that was supposedly for mail fraud and wire fraud against the executives of IRP Solutions. And what did they tell us was the line of questioning that they went they underwent by the prosecutor? That the line of questioning was based on Colorado Springs Fellowship Church. So the prosecutor manipulates them to get them there as a witness, mm-hmm. never tells them you have the right to have an attorney outside of the courtroom if indeed you do have questions or feel like something that we ask you may incriminate you, may be a question that you can't answer, and may be something that you might not even want to attempt to answer because of implications that it could bring against you. In the case of LaWanna Clark, if she would have had an attorney who would have told her the questions that you don't know the answers to, just say that you don't know. Then when she tried to explain to the prosecutor what was going on and that she had no understanding of the business doings because that wasn't her position at IRP mm-hmm. Solutions, if she would have had an attorney outside to say, don't even attempt to answer that question because, as her appellate attorney put it, they are setting you up
yep.
in a perjury trap. They set a perjury trap for you.
Well,
if she would have had an attorney outside who could have told her, don't even go down that line when they ask you that. Tell them you are going to exercise your Fifth Amendment right and not answer that question because it has nothing to do with anything that you had to do with the business.
No, go ahead, Sam.
Yeah, I was just going to say, and the listeners may ask, well, how do you know that the Colorado Springs Fellowship Church was being brought into this? Because the grand jury foreperson,
yes.
Cynthia Haidt, said so.
Said so.
In open court.
In open court, when asked by Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch, who was the target of this investigation, she, as the grand jury foreperson, said Rose Banks, who is the pastor of Colorado Springs Fellowship, is the target of this case. But then mm-hmm. you have Mr. Dorschner, who works for U.S. Attorney John Walsh up in Denver, Colorado, at the U.S. Attorney's office, when he was asked, why did you guys illegally access the bank information, financial information for Colorado Springs Fellowship and for Pastor Rose Banks of Colorado Springs Fellowship?
Mm-hmm.
Is Colorado Springs Fellowship under investigation? Mr. Dorschner's his response was, no, Colorado Springs Fellowship is not under investigation. Rose Banks is not under investigation. This is about IRP Solutions and their business dealings. So then why did you illegally collect, access, and get a copy of their of the banking records of the church?
Well, it goes back to manage, to control, and to play. That's the word that stands out to me. To play upon by an artful manner.
Right.
This is a game, is what this sounds like is going on.
Yeah.
So when you talk about manipulation, the entire process of the grand jury is manipulation.
That's exactly what it is.
The grand jury is manipulated by the U.S. attorney.
Yes, you have the grand jury, the members of that grand jury, sure. the grand jurors, if you would, are being played by the prosecutor because he's putting on a one-sided story
yep.
to say, I'm going to show you why the earth is flat, and here's all the reasons why. Now, if Mr. I believe it was Magellan that proved that the earth was round, if I'm wrong, then I'm wrong. Anybody can correct me. In the chat room, somebody offer me a hand. But if Mr. Magellan, who proved that the earth is round and that the reason we have a sunrise and a sunset is because it spins and it's a sphere, he's nowhere in the courtroom to dispute the prosecutor to say the earth is not flat. Scientific proof shows that it is round and it is rotating on a 24-hour cycle. He's nowhere in the room. The prosecutor gets all of the jurors, the grand jurors. The earth must be flat. He said so. He's the one who he's the authority on everything that we're talking about here, and no one's here to dispute him.
Well, here's what's troubling to me, that, and there's no special selection of a grand jury.
Right.
Okay. So they're the average folks that go to work and get off work, just like a regular jury is convened. I presume a grand jury is convened the same way. If I'm wrong, correct me on that. However, what's puzzling to me, as a we talk all the time that people have to stand up and say, you know, we're not going to take this. If I'm sitting in a jury room as a grand juror, and a U.S. attorney comes in and puts on a case as a juror, I'm going to feel like, are you absolutely kidding me? You want me to indict a man or a woman based upon your thought or theory of the case? Is no one in the jury room asking questions to say, well, what is the other side of the story?
Does
somebody not speak up and say, wait a minute, I know what you're saying, Mr. Prosecutor, but it goes to just how intimidated. Goes back to manipulation. You can manipulate people with intimidation and with fear. And when you got people sitting in a grand jury and you got a U.S. attorney coming in a $200 suit or whatever cost of his suit is, you know what the problem is? The jurors are intimidated by the system. That's what you have.
Well, and I think also, Lamont, part of it, and we've had guests on the program that have talked about this, that part of it is intimidation, obviously. But then the other part is that the grand jurors who they have to serve anywhere from, I guess, depending upon the type of grand jury, they can serve anywhere from 18 to 24 months. And then in special grand juries, I think it could be 18 to 36 months.
Are you serious?
And so
wow.
Through that course of time, and we've had guests on the program to say that there is a rapport that has been built between the mm-hmm. prosecutor and the grand jurors. So although these grand jurors, and as we talked about on one of the previous programs, one of the original purposes for the grand jury was to ensure that citizens were not being railroaded by prosecutors. Yeah. Over the course of the last 100 years, that has changed. And so you have this man that shows up into the grand jury, and the same 16 to 23 people see this same man for 18 to 24 wow. or 18 to 36 months.
Well, you know what?
So it becomes a partnership. It's sure. like you going to work and you have worked at the same company for 2 or 3 years, and someone comes in wow. and they're going to tell you, like Cliff said, that the earth is flat because you have built this rapport with
absolutely.
Them and you have a work relationship with them. You're going to believe them. They're going to come in and they say, this guy, you know, committed XYZ crimes.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I'm Bob. I'm your friend. You know,
mm-hmm. yeah.
you're going to believe me, right?
Well, and by the way, well. I brought in coffee and some bagels.
Yeah.
There's some jelly donuts out there in the hallway for those of you who like jelly. And Jim, I know you have affinity for that teriyaki beef jerky. I brought in you a pound of my homemade stash today.
You know what?
Just give me that indictment.
But you know what they call that? In the criminal world, they call that grooming.
Yeah.
Now,
extortion, maybe?
Grooming. The reason grooming is such an important word here is because it is a act of intent to woo, if you will, a defendant. It is they are there to make the defendant feel like, I care.
Yeah.
Well, if you, and Sam, excellent point to that. 36, almost 2 years?
Almost.
With this
yeah,
guy.
Anywhere from 2 to 3 years.
Who's bringing it, and again, we know nothing about the conversations during the process. After hours, man, are we meeting down going to the local crab shack?
Now, are you having a barbecue on the 4th of July?
Yeah.
Everybody on the grand jury come to my house as
but,
a prosecutor.
But,
we're having barbecue. But, tell me what kind of meat you want, prime rib, brisket?
This explains to me very, very clearly, and it may sound comical, but it is a tragedy. But it shows the level of corruption and manipulation that is happening here. And I didn't even know those figures. 18 to 36 months.
Yep.
That means holiday season?
Several.
Maybe we're exchanging gifts. Maybe we have Secret Santa.
Your kids had birthdays.
How are you going to come back to do or say anything against this particular state attorney? This is absolutely outrageous.
It's sickening. Now, we have a list of frequently asked questions about civil grand juries. And one of those kind of questions is, who supervises grand juries or directs their operations? Now, this is just plainly insane, because it says, strictly speaking, no one is authorized to supervise them. That's the first issue right there.
First problem.
They are so basically you're herding cats when you're talking about the grand jury. They're just all over the place. They do what they want. Nobody supervises them. The statute that specifies who grand jurors may turn to for assistance during their terms of service refers to such persons as legal advisors. So there's no particular group of people that it said if the grand jurors have a question, if they have some type of legal issue that they need an answer for, this is the body of people that they can come to where they can get an unbiased, clear answer, a lawful answer, not just one of the prosecutor saying,
right,
this is my take on what's going on. It says, however, superior court judges are authorized to exercise some authority with respect to the institution. Attempts by other officials, public employees, former grand jurors, or other citizens to control civil grand jurors should be regarded as jury tampering. Now, what it makes you wonder is, do they regard the prosecutor's personal relationships, his, giving favors to them or their families? Is that considered jury tampering? And I guarantee you it's not, because they can say, oh, no, they're just he's on the grand jury. He happens to be a friend of mine that I met 36 months ago when the first grand jury was impaneled on this case. And so we've grown a relationship since then. I know his kids. He knows my kids. I went to their ball game. He came to my kids' graduation. He was there when my daughter got married. Well, you have a friendship, a relationship that is inappropriate for someone who, but I guess, is not an adversarial situation
at all.
You're just coming in saying, hey, you guys, it's me again. We got this guy. He committed this crime. Hey, we don't have all day. It's a beautiful day outside. The barbecue's going on at my house. If we can get out of here, it's 9:30 now. If we can get out of here by 11, hey, the meat's still hot. We might be able to get a softball game in here. Everybody give me signatures on these 50 documents. We can get out of here and go get this barbecue.
But
as
funny as that sounds,
that is
as real.
Exactly. Because the law of the grand jury process allows
it
that
to happen. Enables that.
No supervisor of the grand jury?
How do you – and here's the problem I have. As the more we begin to dig – the problem I have above anything else, there is no branch of government in this country that does not have checks and balances.
That's right.
No branch of government. The president of the United States, who can pardon, who can do executive orders.
That's right.
Who can declare war.
He's answerable to somebody.
He's answerable.
If you look at who supervises the president, the bodies of Congress.
Of government.
They supervise the president. Who supervises grand juries, strictly speaking?
No one
is authorized to supervise.
How is that possible? Go ahead, Sal.
And Cliff, to your point about the steaks are on, the hot dogs are grilling and everything, you remember the story that we had on Sabrina Butler?
Yes.
And she was exonerated. Was that in Alabama or Mississippi?
I think
it
was one of those deeply southern states.
Mm-hmm. And you recall when she said that the district attorney in her county is so corrupt,
yes,
and he's been in office for something like 30 years,
mm-hmm,
or something crazy like that, and he took the grand jury to a picnic.
A picnic, yes. And then the fact is, okay, you take them to a picnic, how inappropriate. Who is holding him accountable for taking them to
Nobody.
The picnic?
Nobody.
Absolutely nobody, because he is the authority as far as the grand jury process. There's no judge there. There's no legal advisors who are there to ensure, that the weights and balances are just. It's just the prosecutor. He's like, you guys know what? We've been in here too long.
Exactly.
Let's go ahead. We need to have some downtime. Hey, I got a picnic going on. We got a few bottles of soda. We got some hot dogs, some hamburgers. Let's have a good time. We'll reconvene tomorrow.
And Cliff, think about the story we just talked about a few days ago, where the grand jury, in a four-hour period, returned 257 indictments.
In 4 hours.
In 4 hours, yeah. And so, like you guys are talking about, if you were to take the scenarios that you're talking about, put it in this situation, you could almost envision a district attorney or a prosecutor walking into the grand jury room and saying, hey, good morning, Bob. Hey, Sue, how you doing? How's that grandbaby doing? Well, guys, we got a full day today. We only got 4 hours. We got 257 things that I need you to hear. But I know, you know, you guys are going to do the right thing, right? And how can you return 257 indictments
in 4 hours?
That's that story that we read about said they did one indictment. It averages out to one indictment every 52 seconds.
How do you even get the paper around the room for signatures?
And the part of the grand jury process, if I read it correctly, the prosecutor actually has to step outside of the room.
Right,
for them, the grand jury to vote.
For them to vote. Because
he's already laid the foundation.
He must have had his Nikes on, man, because he was running.
No, he stood at the door and put one foot in and said, I'm out. Came right back in. Here's the next one. I'm out. Vote. Here's the next one.
He's
vote.
Not
Here's
standing outside the door pondering what decision will come down. The manipulation has already been started.
Exactly.
He couldn't have even presented any evidence. All he did was just said,
sign it.
There you go. Rubber stamp.
Wow.
This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. We're talking about the deception of the grand jury. Our phone number is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. We'd love to hear from you on the downside of the program, so give us a call. But don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
At the inception of A Just Cause Coast to Coast, the host and crew decided to devote a segment of each show to an exoneree moment. The purpose of the exoneree moment was to outline the case and highlight the circumstances that led to a wrongful conviction. AJC Radio also wanted to highlight the successes and failures of the justice system, understanding why the system failed and what ultimately turned the tide and cleared their name. We wanted to hear the personal first-hand accounts. They were appalling, emotional, astounding, and overwhelming. Lives devastated by the system. Most of the people who shared their stories were released from the building, but not from the system. They struggled to get their records expunged and clear their names, find suitable employment and housing, obtain restitution from the state, and reconnect with their families and friends. And it hardly fit the definition of exonerated, which means to free from guilt of blame, to clear from a charge of guilt or fault, to exculpate. These are the stories of lives taken and returned, but must be rebuilt, adapted, reestablished, and transformed. The profile of a wrongly convicted.
Today's profile features Anthony Lemons. On April 14, 1994, the body of 39-year-old Eric Sims, a reputed drug dealer, was found in his apartment in Cleveland, Ohio. He had been shot multiple times, and police believed that he had been dead for several days. In the spring of 1995, two anonymous telephone callers reported to police that a woman named Jude Adamchik had said that she was in the apartment at the time of the murder and that the gunman killed Sims in a drug deal dispute and then shot her as well as fled. Police questioned Adamchik, and she was unable to identify the gunman. Police then showed her a photographic lineup with pictures of men who had been convicted of drug and gun crimes. Adamchik did not identify anyone in the lineup. Among the photographs in the lineup was a picture of 20-year-old Anthony Lemons. Despite Adamchik's failure to identify him as the gunman, police focused their investigation on Lemons. Lemons voluntarily came to the police station and stood in an in-person lineup where Adamchik identified him as the gunman. He was charged with first-degree murder for killing Sims and attempted murder for shooting at Adamchik and went to trial in October 1995. Adamchik identified Lemons at trial and said she recalled that he was wearing a particular brand of shoe at the time of the crime. On October 11, 1995, a jury convicted Lemons of murder and attempted murder. He was sentenced to 21 years to life in prison. He appealed his convictions but lost. He was denied parole repeatedly because he refused to admit he was guilty. In 2009, attorneys filed a motion for a new trial, claiming that the prosecution had failed to disclose critical evidence in Lemons' innocence. The evidence included police reports showing that the shoes that Adamczyk said Lemons was wearing at the time of the crime were not even manufactured or sold until months after the murder. Moreover, the police had failed to disclose that Adamczyk had not identified Lemons when she looked at the photographic lineup that contained Lemons' photograph. In December 2012, Lemons was released on parole. A year later, in December 2013, Court of Common Pleas Judge Janet Burnside granted Lemons' motion for a new trial because of the prosecution's failure to disclose exculpatory evidence 19 years earlier. In December 2014, the prosecution dismissed its appeal and informed Judge Burnside that it would dismiss the charges against Lemons, but wished to serve the right to refile the charge if new evidence was discovered. Judge Burnside refused to grant the prosecution's motion and scheduled the case for trial for December 23, 2014. A few days later, Lemons filed a lawsuit against the City of Cleveland and the Cleveland Police Department seeking damages for his wrongful conviction. On December 23, 2014, Judge Burnside called the case for trial, and when the prosecution presented no evidence, the judge acquitted Lemons. This has been a profile of the wrongly convicted with AJC Radio.
You are listening to AJC Radio.
The opinions and views expressed by guests and callers on A Just Cause Coast to Coast do not necessarily reflect those of A Just Cause or A Just Cause Coast to Coast.
A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. Our phone number is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. You know, Lamont, you were making some excellent points about the depth of the corruption that is exposed, you know, as we talk about the grand jury process.
Yeah, and you know, we go back to the Eric Garner case. When a man is, you know, we asked ourselves this question when it hit the news this summer, this past year. How does a grand jury come back with a no indictment in that case? When a man is holding his hands up, he's showing no type of violence. And Cliff, you made a good point. That information, when a judge goes before a jury and admonishes a jury or gives jury instruction, this is at the beginning of a trial and at the end of a trial.
Mm-hmm.
His words are, you are not allowed to consider any evidence outside of this room that's presented to you by this prosecutor today, which means the grand jury, they tell the jury and a grand jury, you're not to watch TV, don't
right.
go to the internet, you're not to get any type of outside influence in your decision.
You can't do your own research.
You
have to go off of what's going on here in the courtroom. And when you look at the Eric Garner case, when you line everything up and you lay the whole thing out, when you look at a case and you look at the way that the so-called American justice system works, you realize exactly what's happened. Because in the Eric Garner case, what was the first thing that they did? They went after the man with the video camera.
Sure.
Said, you are under arrest for, I can't remember what it was. He had some, I believe, and I may be mistaken, I think he had a warrant for something very minor.
Right.
It was a gun possession charge.
Mm-hmm.
They went after him for that so that they could discredit him as a viable witness or anything that he presented. So now you tell the grand jury, look, this evidence of this videotape is under investigation. The individual who came up with this evidence is a criminal.
Absolutely.
He has a criminal background. He has been arrested. He is under indictment.
Mm-hmm.
They give you all of this information to discredit the person who took the video, and then say, furthermore, you cannot consider any evidence that is brought outside of this courtroom. You cannot consider anything you've seen in the media, anything that has not been approved by this prosecutor, by this court, anything that any research you've done on your own. You cannot consider anything except what this prosecutor is presenting to you today, and then they threaten you mm-hmm. as a juror, or you could be brought up on obstruction of justice charges. Why? because you're seeking justice. That's how they manipulate the grand jury.
Sure.
That's how they manipulate witnesses of the grand jury, and then tell you everything in here is a secret. If you tell anybody how we threatened you or beat you behind closed doors, we will take you to prison.
Well, what's bizarre, again, well, this thing is full of bizarre situations, but what you have, like you said, the acts of fear and intimidation put on the grand jury. Now here, once you plant the seed with the grand juror and say, you know, again, they're not accountable, nobody can, whatever tone, this is grooming, this is getting into the head of a juror, not about, so you, all these actions are going on because the evidence is not there.
Right.
So we have to use, again, what this show is about, manipulation, deception. So what you do, you go in and say, you know what, there's some video that you may have heard of that is highly questionable.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as a juror, I may sit here and think, oh, maybe something was doctored. Perhaps this is a fake. Perhaps the video is not real. Well, you've planted enough doubt right there for them not to consider the truth. Goes, again, to the act of manipulation. It goes to control.
Mm-hmm.
The controlling and to artfully, skillfully be and act unfair.
Yes, and then and when you look at the research team just sent me the article about Mr. Orta, who was the one who did the video. Thanks you guys for that. When you look at what the police released to the media about this man, all it's doing is trying to discredit him
and prejudice him.
And prejudice
discredit
him.
Who?
Mr. Orta, who was the one
gotcha.
He videotaped the chokehold death of Eric Garner. So they try to discredit him. This is a part of the release of information that they put out about Mr. Orta. It said, you know, that the man who recorded police allegedly placing Eric Garner in a chokehold was related on a weapons charge in Staten Island. Then it goes down some information, but then it says this: Orta allegedly tucked the gun, the unloaded 25 caliber firearm, into the waistband of this person who was with him, yada, yada, yada. Then it says narcotics officers had watched the pair enter the hotel, which is allegedly well known for drug activity. The gun was reported stolen from Michigan in 2007, police said. Mm-hmm. Does that mean the gun is still being reported stolen, or did he buy it from someone else in a legal manner? The gun was reported stolen from Michigan in 2007. Was the gun recovered? Was it used in some type of crime? What does that have to do with Mr. Orta? Then it says, Orta has been arrested several times in recent years, including for assault, robbery, and weapons possession. What does that have to do with a videotape that he possesses, that he recorded, that says, that shows you choking Eric Garner to death? Now, all of his possessions, since he's arrested now,
mm-hmm.
His possessions are in custody. So yeah. Where is the video? We do not have that original video. What you saw on the internet, what you saw on the news was only part of the story. You cannot use that, grand jurors, to come to any conclusion, because what you saw was a piece of what is now in police custody under the chain of custody of evidence, mm-hmm. and cannot be released anywhere within the next 2-year period, because it is being used in an ongoing pending case with other videotapes, text messages, phone calls that may be used in some of Orta's other crimes, including assault, robbery, and weapons possession.
Well,
that is how they discredit him
immediately
and say this video, you don't even know what they will convince you. You don't even know what you saw on that video.
But here's what's sad. This is where they got him. And this is what a juror was going to get outraged about. This is manipulation. Now you're skillfully using information to discredit this man. Ramsey Orta, 22, was charged with second degree criminal possession of a weapon after he allegedly walked out of a Central Avenue hotel with a 17-year-old girl.
Yeah, they are.
You understand?
Was it his daughter, cousin, his sister? He's 22 with a 17-year-old girl.
Now that's the play on the emotion.
Yeah, right. That's the play, like, oh my God, he's with a 17-year-old girl. What was he doing with her in that hotel?
And then he says here, and he gave her a gun.
He gave her a gun. It's like,
bam. Now, if you leave it right there, they're like, oh, my God. There's nothing this man has that we're interested in. This man is a criminal.
And then it says, the young man who filmed the NYPD killing Eric Garner was arrested shortly after on trumped-up charges. He has since been locked up at Notorious Rikers Prison, New York. Immediately following the killing of Eric Garner, and I say the murder of Eric Garner, Orta was stalked and targeted by police. They allegedly scrutinized Orta's daily life until they were able to find something to charge him with. Eventually, he was confronted by police, who illegally searched him and arrested him for the nonviolent charge of carrying an unregistered firearm. Orta had expressed concern for his safety after his arrest because he was sure the police were retaliating against him for exposing what they had done to Eric Garner. So they said, we are going to find something on you no matter how long it takes because we have to discredit you and we have to get that video into police custody and say that everything that is owned by you, everything in possession of you, is now under police custody and can be used for nothing. That is how the system is run in America. Mm. And that is what the public doesn't understand, that that's how it works. Right. How do you think that suddenly, sure, the videos, it's on CNN, it's on YouTube, it's all over the place. Find out if that video was used as evidence.
Probably not.
During the grand jury
process. Absolutely not.
No. They discredited it by saying Orta is under investigation, he's under arrest, and that video is part of other evidence that may be used in some of his assault, robbery, and possession charges.
And you know, in criminal proceedings, see, this is so backwards. You cannot bring up prior acts of a defendant. If he is in the courtroom, the prosecution cannot say, well, he committed this crime a year ago, unless he chooses to take the stand. But in most cases, if he does not take that stand, guess what? You can't bring up his prior acts to show anything because it will prejudice the jury.
Exactly.
But you're telling me you can go in here, one-sided, they can say, man, Eric Garner was, you know, he was overweight, and he was a big man, threatening.
And he also sold some cigarettes that he owed $2.37 in tax.
But they're not going to say that. They're going to say he's smuggling cigarettes.
Exactly.
Well, and you know, the thing is, they can't, or let me put it this way, like you said, Lamont, they're not supposed to talk about their past or what have you, but they can dog you so bad, and they can say things within the legal realm that they're painting a picture to that jury that you are someone that should be convicted.
Absolutely.
That's what happened in the IRP 6 case.
Mm-hmm.
But on the flip side, Judge Arguello would not allow the IRP 6 to talk about their record from the positive perspective. I mean, you know, the IRP 6 being active in their community, active in the church, helping people, being positive role models, having professions, not, you know, they were not scam artists, they were not schemesters, they had professions in the IT industry, and Judge Arguello says that your character is not on trial? Are you kidding me?
Well,
you're calling me a criminal.
Yeah. I mean, how does she know what's on trial? Was she in the grand jury room when the prosecutor painted these six men probably as hardened criminals? These are men that are taken from, I mean, they teach you in public speaking on exactly, and I'm going to tell you, these prosecutors, they're trained to do this, to go into and play upon the emotions of human beings. See, that's how sick it is. You know, that could have been your mother, your father that they took that money from.
Yeah, they manipulate your emotions trying to get a conviction. And that's what we see on, you know, in a regular courtroom. This secret grand jury proceeding crap.
Right.
There's no telling what goes on. And I got to go back to the who supervises the grand jury, you know, or directs their operation. Nobody?
That doesn't even make
sense.
Nobody.
So basically, just like we dealt with last week, the prosecutor is the, you know, the end-all authority in that courtroom when it comes to grand jury. He's basically saying, hey, I'm judge, jury, and executioner here.
Period.
And if you go against what I'm doing, hey, I'll have you brought up on charges of perjury, on charges of
obstruction
of justice. That is what they do best, is threaten people. I mean, that's how they get their
they get their
plea deals off of these indictments. But when you look at it, you like, how could there be a fair grand jury process. First off, the prosecutor is allowed, he's the only one side of a story.
Allowed in the grand jury.
Every story has two sides, and if you only hear one, then the no doubt and absolutely the story you heard is prejudiced towards the person who's telling.
Well, that's common sense.
Exactly.
I don't have to be a law student to figure out if I go to a courtroom and the prosecution rests their case, the judge says, jury, go to the jury room and start deliberating. That's how insane that
is. That's exactly it.
What am I deliberating?
You, and the defense is like, hey, wait, we haven't given our case. Well,
that doesn't apply here.
They don't need to hear your case. You may as well not even be in the room. But it shows the level of manipulation, because any common sense person would think, what's the other side of the story?
They gotta be.
There's gotta be. It's like. Well, just like in the first grand jury in the IRP 6 case,
mm-hmm.
when the grand jury, one of the jurors asked, "Well, this is debt, right? You're telling me that you can come after me if I'm in debt, if I owe some bills? Is that what you're telling me?" See, when they had evidence from both sides presented to them,
it raises questions,
and they had witnesses that the grand jury, the prosecutor thought, I'm going to bring these witnesses in. I'm going to manipulate them and turn them to my favor. But it backfired on them. As when we heard last week from some of these witnesses that went before the grand jury, said, they were outraged at the questions. Like, how dare you bring my religious rights into question when you told me that I was coming here to talk to you about mail fraud and wire fraud? Now you bring my religious rights into question? Mm-hmm. How dare you do that? So what does U.S. Attorney Walsh do? He says, "Well, I'll bring one FBI agent in, one witness, off of my side
mm-hmm.
to retell my story and collaborate the lies that I tell
mm-hmm.
to ensure that we get this indictment." And when that happened, sure, absolutely, they get an indictment. But it shows you the manipulation, because when the grand jury is given the information they need to make a true decision,
they ask questions.
To weigh the evidence, mm-hmm. then they ask questions. If you say, "I want to present to you that these people committed a crime," and nothing else, they committed a crime, and I need for you to say if they did or if they didn't. Well, prosecutor, where's your evidence?
That's right.
My evidence is the fact that I said it. And when you look at some of the transcripts,
mm-hmm.
he was like, "Well, how do you know this happened?"
I just know.
That is the sickest thing on the planet. Where's the evidence? I just know. Now you have to go off of the evidence that I just presented you, which was the fact that I know. So you have to take me at my word, because I'm the prosecutor and I don't lie.
And then it goes on to say, I know, and I'm wearing a badge, and my friend brought me in here to you guys, who you've been working with for 24, 36 months. So, you know, the stage is set.
Wow.
I mean, it's such a crooked process that people are just not aware of. Okay, Cliff, I think we got a few minutes here to go to the phones. Is that right?
No, not yet. We're still trying to get an individual on. Olivia, if you can give us a heads up as to what's going on. Obviously, the clock is running short, so we got a few minutes before we start wrapping up. But, when you really look at what's going on here, I mean, we've done research, as talking to you on the show about this manipulation of the grand jury. Our research team has brought us some information that I have, probably not considered before. I am baffled at this list of frequently asked questions. And who supervises them? Nobody. Who has jurisdiction? The prosecutor. Who runs the process? The prosecutor. Who ensures that evidence of a defendant's innocence is presented? The prosecutor.
And has no stopping point of how many grand juries he can convene.
That's right. If you say that, well, I didn't get an indictment that time, let me just really scrape it down to
revamp the story.
Yeah, just revamp the story to, I'll give them a 10-minute, or in the case of that one grand jury that we talked about, we'll give them 52 seconds of we'll read them a paragraph and tell them that's the evidence that we have. Now you must vote.
And he can go back to his office and set out another scheme. mm-hmm. and say, okay, these are mistakes I made in convening that first grand jury. This is some options and obstacles we ran into. Let me correct that.
Yes.
And come back. So that's basically going into your opponent's playbook, seeing exactly what's there and say, okay, we won the game.
Or worse than that, Lamont, what if you have a grand jury that you presented a case to, and then it comes up to the end of that grand jury's term. So you didn't get what you wanted in that first grand jury. So now you got a new set of people, a new set of 16 to 23 people who are now in a new grand jury term who had not heard about the case at all. They didn't know anything about it. And you present to them this situation the way, like Cliff said, you kind of put the right spin on it that you want to put on it. And then you get the indictment. I mean, that's terrible. I mean, you would think that if the same grand jury heard it, then they'd say, wait a minute, we've heard this before.
Right.
So why is it a different story now than it was when we heard it previously? I mean, you almost have to believe that prosecutors will use that type of tactic, especially if it's still within the statute of limitation.
Well, see, that's the thing. They can impanel a grand jury
as
when
many
they
times
feel like
as they want.
They can say, well, we had one grand jury. You know what? We're not going to keep them for 36 months. They're not giving us the type of numbers.
We're not hearing what we want to hear.
We're not hearing what we want to hear from them. Let's go ahead, dismiss them. We'll impanel another grand jury, and we'll get a fresh list of, of guinea pigs, per se, and we'll manipulate them, get them to go through the maze. We'll put the cheese right there in the middle, and we'll spray it down with all kind of fresh scents of what we want it to be called.
It's horrible.
And get the results that we want. I mean, to that process is so sick, because you're manipulating the grand jurors, you're manipulating the witnesses, you're manipulating the court system, you're manipulating the process, due process, you're manipulating all type of constitutional laws and guidelines and everything. How could it be a fair? Now I understand even more how they get their 98%.
Absolutely.
This is sick.
It's not exactly.
For archives of this evening's program on deception of the grand jury, go out to ajcradio.com. Also, you can get 24/7 AJC IRP programming at live365.com. Then you can catch us each Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, and you can get there by going to prn.fm. For on-demand programming, go to the 405 Radio or iTunes. And we ask that you also keep the IRP 6 in your prayers. That's David Banks, Dave Zappolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, Demetrius Harper, and Gary Walker. For more information on the IRP 6, go to freetheirp6.org. And then we also ask that you help out their families. We talked earlier on the program. These men have now been incarcerated for nearly 3 years under a wrongful conviction. And certainly a wrongful conviction equals to wrongful incarceration. But their families have been impacted by this. These men were the primary breadwinners. And so we ask that you go out to www.gofundme.com. That's GOFUNDME.com. And you can make contributions directly to the families of the IRP 6. Just do a search on IRP 6, and we would certainly appreciate any support that you can provide there. Cliff.
I want to say thank you to our production team, Captain Kyle and Dustin Jackson of K&D Productions, making sure it is that you hear, making sure you hear what we have to say. They're helping out El Skillet Girl in the control room, and I think the coffee is finally kicking in on. I want to say thank you to everybody in the chat room for all your questions, your comments, everybody who called in to Mr. Solomon. We appreciate you coming on, but we didn't get a chance to go to you. You get with Olivia, we maybe were able to reschedule for a future show. Also, I want to say thank you to our production support team. They give us accurate and up-to-date information so we can pass it on to you. To the truth, we know you're out there. We appreciate it. Got that part right.
And also to Olivia, Ms. Barbara, and Lynette, thanks for the support you provide and all the work that you're doing behind the scenes. And to Howell Wolf for calling in and Howell making some significant comments and contributions to this evening's show. We appreciate the support that Howell is providing. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Join us each Tuesday and Thursday right here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm Sam Thurman on behalf of Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. Good night, America.
Good night.